Creative Impulse with Sylvia Sims, Desmond Barrett and Shirley Ann Field, and Dirk Bogard as the narrator.
As an author, Mrs. Albert Forrester had long been a darling of the critics, but she'd had no public following at all. Suddenly, at the advanced age of 57, she shot into public favour with her novel, The Achilles Statue.
And now we turn to the theatre. The Achilles Statue opened at the Haymarket last Wednesday. I joined our drama critic, Philip Eade, for the first night, but I believe you've all seen the production since.
Yes. Yes.
Philip Eade.
Well, the Achilles Statue is, of course, a dramatisation of the enormously successful novel by Mrs. Albert Forrester. Yes. Discussing the production in the interval, Clifford Boylston and I made the effort to judge the play on its merits as a piece of theatre, but we both felt that admirers of Mrs. Forrester's writing are bound to be disappointed. At least half the pleasure to be derived from the Achilles Statue comes from Mrs. Forrester's marvellous prose style.
Exactly.
Much of this is, of course, lost in the transmogrification of the novel into a stage play.
I do so agree.
Rose Waterford.
The Achilles Statue is without question one of the great novels of our time. Yeah. It has achieved that rare distinction. It's pleased both the book-buying public and the critics, though not perhaps for the same reasons. Many of us have been trumpeting Mrs. Albert Forrester's literary merits for many years to a public that was both deaf and blind to them.
Yes.
Now, at last, she has achieved the popular acclaim that has so long eluded her.
Indeed.
I suppose very few people know how Mrs. Albert Forrester came to write her masterpiece, The Achilles Statue. I happen to be one of the very few.
Jonathan Pill.
Well, I too have long admired the delights of Mrs. Forrester's prose style, but I believe her verse demonstrates even more clearly the great subtlety with which she deploys the English language.
And nothing is more subtle, I suggest, or more typical of Mrs. Forrester than her choice of Latin titles for her six volumes of verse.
Yes. Lillian Preston.
By giving her books titles such as Felicita, Pax Maris, Ice Triplex, and so forth, she is acknowledging the enormous debt that her English style owes to its classical origin.
Yes. If a knowledge of the classics leads to an appreciation of grammar, it is undoubtedly true that she understands the rules of grammar as no other living writer in the language.
Mm. Yes,
she can make one smile at her placing of a comma.
Oh, I so agree, Rose Waterford. Her humour is not so much of ideas or even of words. It is humour of the punctuation.
Oh,
it is her distinction to have discovered the comic possibilities of the semicolon.
The more cultured the reader, the greater the amusement to be derived from her punctuation.
Which, of course, Chairman, leads me to question the wisdom of adapting her work for the essentially coarser medium of the stage,
with all
the constraints that mere dialogue and the proscenium arch impose.
That too.
How did this great novel of our time come into existence? As I'm one of the charmed circle that knows the true story behind its genesis, I feel I owe it to you, the book-buying public, as well as to all serious students of literature, present and future, to lay the facts before you. Mrs. Albert Forrester lived in a flat not far from Marble Arch. It had a handsome drawing room and a large bedroom for Mrs. Albert Forrester, and a small pokey bedroom for Mr. Albert Forrester, who paid the rent. It was in this handsome drawing room that Mrs. Forrester every Tuesday afternoon received her friends.
Oh, come in, Albert, come in. I think you know everybody here. Have you just come from the city? Would you like a cup of tea?
No, thank you, my dear. I had tea in the office.
Albert, I know you'd like a second cup. Miss Warren, pour Mr. Forrester a cup, would you? Now, this must be settled once and for all. And after all, it's something on which Albert might have something to say. Let's have the benefit of his opinion.
My opinion? About what?
Shall I? Or shall I not have my hair shingled?
shingled.
Get short, bobbed, it's all the rage.
Oh, you must. You look too wonderful.
I'd counsel caution. I think that when one has made a type, one should stick to it. What would Louis XIV have been without his wig?
Well, I am hesitating. But I suppose we must move with the times. I don't want to lag behind. America, as William Meister has it, is here and now. What does my lord and master say about it? What is your opinion, Albert? To shingle or not to shingle? That is the question. Will it suit me?
It might. My only fear is that with your statuesque appearance, short hair would perhaps suggest, well, shall we say, the Isle of Greece, where burning Sappho loved and sung.
I always thought Byron a very mediocre poet.
If Mrs. Albert Forrester has succeeded with her Tuesday tea parties in creating something akin to the French salon of the 18th century, her Saturday luncheons were even more celebrated. She chose her guests with care, statesmen, artists, writers, clerics, foreign dignitaries. And an invitation was more than a compliment. It was a consecration. For it must be said that Mrs. Forrester, uniquely among those dispensing literary hospitality, gave you uncommonly good food.
If people do me the honour to break bread with me, it's only fair that I give them food at least as good as they could get at home.
My dear lady, I never eat as well as this at home. How on earth do you produce such magnificent fare?
Oh, you mustn't praise me, Lord Conway. All honour to Mrs. Bullfinch.
Who is Mrs. Bullfinch?
Mrs. Bullfinch, Archbishop, is my cook.
Oh, she's a treasure, then. Watch out I don't steal her.
Oh.
Oh, you're not going to ask me to believe that she's responsible for the wine as well.
Is it good, Lord Conway?
Excellent.
I'm terribly ignorant of such things. I leave all that to Albert. Don't I, dear?
It was Albert who, to some, made Mrs. Forrester's luncheons less attractive than her tea parties. For Albert was a bore. But though doubtless perfectly conscious of the fact, she made a point of his coming to her. She would never admit to the world that she'd married a man who was not spiritually her equal. Even if in the silent watches of the night, she asked herself where indeed such could have been found.
Dreadful that such a woman should be burdened by such a man.
Lord alone knows how she ever came to marry him.
One never knows why anybody marries anyone.
But he's such a cipher. When you look into a room Albert's just entered, there's nobody there.
He was always there when he was wanted and never when he wasn't. Mrs. Albert Forrester was the first to acknowledge his merit.
I really don't know what I should do without Albert. He's invaluable to me. I read him everything I write.
And do you find his criticisms useful?
Invaluable.
Oh, come, my dear. You know very well that without you he wouldn't exist.
Oh, isn't that somewhat harsh?
Nonsense. Just think how wonderful it must be to him to come in contact with all the best brains of our day.
Though what he makes of it all, heaven alone knows.
We who belong to the intelligentsia are apt to live in a world too exclusively our own.
True.
We stand in danger of becoming a little inhuman. I shall always be grateful to Albert because he keeps me in contact with a man in the street.
A man in the street, precisely.
Good heavens, what on earth is going on? Miss Warren, would you mind ringing the bell? It sounds as though the house is falling down.
Or perhaps the Red Revolution has broken out at last.
You rang, Mum?
What on earth is happening out there, Carter?
If you please, Mum, it's the new cook's box. The porter dropped it as he was bringing it in. The cook's ever so upset about it.
What do you mean by the new cook?
Mrs. Bullfinch went away this afternoon, Mum.
Went away? This is the first I've heard of it. Had Mrs. Bullfinch given notice? The moment Mr. Forrester comes in, tell him that I wish to speak to him.
Very good, Mum.
a catastrophe.
But you must get her back. A cook like that, they don't grow on trees, and she gets better and better.
Yes. What is it, Carter?
This letter, Mum.
What is it?
Mr. Forrester said I was to give you this letter when you asked for him.
Where is Mr. Forrester, then?
Mr. Forrester's gone, Mum.
Gone? Gone where? Oh, that'll be all, Carter.
Yes, Mum. Thank you, Mum.
Perhaps he's so distraught at losing Mrs. Bullfinch. He's thrown himself into the Thames.
Monstrous! Monstrous! Monstrous!
My dear Mrs. Forrester, what is it?
I can't believe it. It's incredible!
But what has happened? Oh, please don't keep us in suspense.
I'll tell you what's happened. Credit this if you're able. Albert has eloped with the cook. Miss Warren? Miss Warren, will you control yourself? Miss Warren, if you cannot control yourself, kindly leave the room. This instant, Miss Warren, if you please.
Hysteria. The woman ought to be locked up.
Mrs. Forrester, your letter.
Please read it.
Oh, do you really think...
Oh, yes. Yes, do read it. Read it aloud.
Well, if you... my dear, Mrs. Bullfinch is in need of a change.
And has decided to leave. And as I do not feel inclined to stay on here without her, I am going too. I have had all the literature I can stand, and I'm fed up with art. Mrs. Bullfinch is not concerned about marriage, but if you care to divorce me, she is willing to marry me. I hope you will find the new cook satisfactory. She has excellent references. It may save you trouble if I inform you that Mrs. Bullfinch and I are living at
411 Kennington Road, Albert.
Goodness gracious me.
One doesn't know what to say.
What does Mrs. Bullfinch look like?
Look like? How should I know? I've never looked at her. Albert always engaged the servants. She just came in for a moment so that I could assure myself that her aura was satisfactory.
But you must have seen her every morning when you did the housekeeping.
Albert did the housekeeping. It was his own wish so that I could be free to devote myself to my work. One has to limit oneself in this life, you know.
Did Albert order your luncheons?
Naturally. It was his province.
Well, he certainly knows all about good food and wine.
You must get him back.
Get him back? What on earth can you mean? I will never see him again as long as I live. Take him back? Never. Not even if he came and begged me on bended knees.
I didn't say take him back. I said, get him back. My dear Mrs. Forrester, you know you have no warmer admirer of your art than I. We all agree that you need fair comparison with no living writer, in prose or in verse, and you have humour.
Oh, is there anyone in the world who can put such a wealth of wit and satire and comic observation into a semicolon?
But the fact remains that you don't sell. The poor benighted public will not spend their money to purchase what you write.
Alas. I have come into the world too late. I should have lived in the 18th century, when the wealthy patron rewarded a dedication with 100 guineas.
Indeed. But in the 20th century, you are entirely reliant on Albert, which is why I repeat, my dear Mrs. Forrester, that you must get him back.
I would rather live in a garret. Do you think I'm going to submit to this affront he has put upon me?
It is a bit much, old man.
Would you have me battle for his affections with my cook?
Scarcely.
There is one thing which is more valuable to me than my ease, and that is my dignity.
Well said, Mrs. Forrester. I grant you all that, but consider your standing in the literary world. My dear Mrs. Forrester, in your position, there is one thing you can't afford to be.
And what is that?
A joke.
A joke? Oh. Explain yourself, Mr. Boylston.
I know nothing about Mrs. Bullfinch. For all I know, she's a very respectable woman. But the fact remains that a man doesn't run away with his cook without making his wife ridiculous.
Oh.
If it had been a dancer or someone with a title, I dare say it would have done you no harm. But a cook? A cook would finish you. In a week, you'll have all London laughing at you. And if there's one thing that kills an author or a politician stone dead, it's ridicule. And so I repeat, you must get your husband back. And you must get him back pretty damn quick.
You can count on our discretion.
Can I?
Of course.
Oh, we're all friends here.
Of course you can rely on our discretion, my dear. After all, you were the acknowledged leader of our set. Albert has run away not only from you, but from us all.
That's true. Mm. The fact is, Albert has made all of us look a lot of damn fools.
Oh. I'm afraid he's quite right, Mrs. Forrester. We're all in the same boat. A man in the street must return.
What must I do?
Why not go and see him tomorrow?
He did leave you his address.
And beg him to reconsider his decision.
It's the only thing. Will you do it?
Not for my sake, but for the sake of my art. Oh. I will not allow the ribald laughter of the Philistine to besmirch all that I hold good and true and beautiful.
Oh, well said indeed, Mrs. Forrester.
I must take my leave, my dear Mrs. Forrester. May I look in tomorrow evening, I hope by then, to find you and Mr. Forrester together once again. The events of the next day came to me direct from the lips of Mrs. Forrester, so I have no hesitation in passing them on to you as a true and accurate account of what took place. It was late-ish in the afternoon when Mrs. Albert Forrester, imposing in black silk, arrived in the Kennington Road. Number 411 was one of a row of shabby houses that stood some way back from the street. A paved way led up to a latticed wooden porch badly in need of a coat of paint. The door was opened by a scraggy girl of 15, with long legs and a tousled head.
Does Mrs. Bullfinch live here?
You rang the wrong bell. Second floor. Mrs. Bullfinch! A party to see you, Mrs. Bullfinch! Up there.
Up there? Good afternoon, Bullfinch. I wish to see your master.
Come in, ma'am. Albert, here's Mrs. Forrester to see you.
And there was Albert, sitting by the fire, in a leather-covered but rather shabby armchair, with his feet in slippers and in shirt sleeves. He rose to his feet.
How are you, my dear? Keeping well, I hope?
You better put your jacket on, Albert. What will Mrs. Forrester think of you finding you like that? Come along now, here. That's better.
I received your letter, Albert.
Well, I suppose you had, or you wouldn't have known my address, would you?
Won't you sit down, ma'am?
Thank you.
Would you care for a cup of tea, ma'am?
I think not, Bullfinch, in the circumstances, Albert. I would have preferred to see you alone.
Since anything you have to say concerns Mrs. Bullfinch quite as much as it concerns me, I think it much better that she should be present.
As you wish.
Mrs. Albert Forrester had never consciously looked at Mrs. Bullfinch before, but had retained a dim impression of a large apron over a print dress. She was now wearing a white silk blouse, a black skirt, and high-heeled patent leather shoes with silver buckles. She was a buxom woman of about 45, with reddish hair and a good-natured look. She reminded Mrs. Albert Forrester of a somewhat overblown serving wench in a jolly picture by a Dutch master.
Well, my dear, what have you to say to me?
Of course, you know this is perfectly absurd, Albert. I think you must be out of your mind.
Oh, do you, my dear? Fancy that.
I'm not angry with you. Only amused. But a joke's a joke and shouldn't be carried too far. I've come to take you home.
Wasn't my letter quite clear?
Perfectly clear. That's why I'm asking no questions. And you'll never hear a word of reproach cross my lips. We will look upon this whole episode as a momentary aberration and say no more about it.
My dear, nothing on earth will ever induce me to live with you again.
Albert! You're not serious.
Perfectly serious, my dear.
Do you love this woman?
We get on very well together. Don't we, old girl?
Not so bad.
If
Bullfinch has any regard or respect for you, she must know that the thing is impossible. After the life you've led and the society you've moved in, she can hardly expect to make you permanently happy in miserable furnished lodgings.
Furnished lodgings? These aren't furnished lodgings, ma'am. The furniture's all me own. I've bought it over the years. I've always had an home of me own. I'm very independent-like.
And a very nice, cosy little place it is.
Oh.
Mrs. Albert Forrester looked about her. There was a kitchen range in the fireplace on which a kettle was simmering, and on the mantelshelf was a black marble clock flanked by black marble candlesticks. A door at the back, covered with a red plush curtain, led into what Mrs. Albert Forrester could not but conclude was the only bedroom.
Have you not been happy with me, Albert?
My dear, we've been married for 35 years. It's too long.
Oh.
A great deal too long. You're a good enough woman in your way, but you don't suit me. You're literary, artistic, and I'm not.
I've always made certain you shared in all my interests. I bent over backwards to ensure you weren't overshadowed by my success. You can't say that I've ever left you out of things.
I don't. The trouble is, they're not things in which I have the slightest interest.
Oh,
you're a wonderful writer. I don't deny that for a moment. But the truth is, I don't like the books you write.
And that, if I may be permitted to say so, merely shows that you have very bad taste.
And I don't like your friends. I'll let you into a secret, my dear. Often at your parties, I've had an almost irresistible impulse to take off all my clothes just to see what would happen.
Nothing would have happened. I should merely have sent for the doctor.
Besides, you haven't the figure for that, Albert.
Does 35 years of total faithfulness mean nothing, Albert? Never once in all our married life together have I ever looked at another man. I'm used to you, Albert. I'd be lost without you.
I've left all the menus with the new cook, ma'am. You've only got to tell her how many to luncheon and she'll manage. She's very reliable. And she has a lighter hand with puff pastry as anyone I've ever known.
I am not concerned with puff pastry, Bullfinch. I am concerned with truth and beauty. Albert, I have striven for truth and beauty in our life together. Will you cast all that aside?
I'm afraid you're wasting your time, my dear. My decision is final. I'm not very young anymore, and I want someone to take care of me. I shall, of course, make you as good an allowance as I can. Corrine wants me to retire.
Corrine? Who on earth is Corrine?
It's my name, ma'am. My mother was our French.
That explains a great deal.
What I say is Albert's worked long enough. It's about time he started enjoying himself.
Enjoying himself?
I discussed the matter with my partners today, and they're willing to buy me out. It means a certain sacrifice. When everything is settled, I shall have an income of £900 a year. There are three of us, so it gives us £300 a year each.
£300? How am I to live on that? I have my position to keep up.
Well, there's your writing, my dear. You have a very fertile pen.
You know perfectly well that my books don't bring me in anything but reputation.
Why don't you write a good, thrilling detective story?
Me?
It's not a bad idea. Not a bad idea at all. It could make money.
I should have the critics down on me like a ton of bricks.
I'm not so sure of that. A detective story by Mrs. Albert Forrester? You will elevate the whole species. Highbrows will fall over themselves to find new depths in this class of literature, which they probably all read anyway, but won't admit to. You will make it respectable. You will earn their undying gratitude.
The idea is preposterous.
Written in your beautiful English, they won't be afraid to call it a masterpiece. And detective novels sell in their thousands. They print them in paper covers, and then they sell in tens of thousands. They make them into stage plays and into films. Good detective story writers earn a fortune.
Think of Edgar Wallace.
Precisely. No, no. The genre is absolutely foreign to my genius. I could never hope to please the masses.
Why not? The public all know your name, but they don't read you because you bore them. The fact is, my dear, you're dull.
Oh.
Give them a good, thrilling story, and at the same time, let them think they're improving their minds, and you'll make a fortune.
But But I've never read a detective story in my life.
The first thing to remember is you don't want any lovemaking. It's out of place in a detective story. What you want is murder and sleuth hounds, and you don't want to be able to guess who's done it till the last page.
But you must play fair with your reader, Corinne. Puzzle your reader as much as you can, but don't make a fool of him.
I love a good detective story. Give me a lady in evening dress, just dripping with diamonds, lying on the library floor with a dagger in her heart, and I know I'm in for a treat.
There's no accounting for tastes. Now, personally, I prefer a respectable family solicitor with side whiskers and a benign appearance, lying dead in Hyde Park.
With his throat cut?
No, stabbed in the back. I rather like the idea that every one of us, even the most apparently blameless, has a mystery in his life.
Do you?
We can give you all the tips, my dear. I've read hundreds of detective stories.
You?
Well, that's what first brought Corinne and me together. I used to pass them on to her when I'd finished them.
Now I see what a gulf separates us. You have been surrounded for 30 years with all that was best in English literature, and you've read hundreds of detective novels.
Hundreds and hundreds.
I came here willing to make any reasonable concession so that you should come back to your home. But now, I wish it no longer. You have shown me that we have nothing in common and never had. There is an abyss between us. Good day to you both.
Oh, here she is at last.
Hello, everybody.
Oh, no, Albert.
You poor things. You've had no tea.
No, Miss Warren.
I haven't an idea what the time is, but I know I'm fearfully late.
Well?
Well?
My dears, I've got something quite wonderful to tell you.
Yes.
I've had an inspiration. Why should the devil have all the best tunes?
What do you mean?
My dear, I'm going to write a detective story. Now, don't say a word. No, listen. I am going to raise the detective story to the dignity of art. I shall withhold the solution until the final page. And since it occurred to me lately that perhaps I've exhausted the possibilities of the semicolon, I'm going to take up the colon. Oh, humour and mystery are what I aim at. I shall call it the Achilles statue.
Oh, what a title! You'll sell the serial right on the title and your name alone.
But what about Albert?
Albert? Albert. Oh, Albert! I knew I'd gone out on some errand. I was walking through Hyde Park when I had this inspiration. Albert slipped right out of my mind. Oh, what a fool you must think me.
Then you haven't seen Albert.
My dear, I've forgotten all about him. Let Albert keep his cook. I can't bother about Albert now. Albert belongs to the semicolon period. Onward and upward.
Were I in a position to seek Mrs. Albert Forrester's agreement to breaking her confidence and providing the facts behind the creation of the Achilles statue, I'm sure at this distance in time she would have approved. Mrs. Albert Forrester was ever a doubted champion of truth.
In The Creative Impulse by Somerset Maugham, Dirk Bogart was the narrator, with Sylvia Sims as Mrs. Forrester, Desmond Barrett as Mr. Forrester, and Shirley Ann Field as Mrs. Bullfinch. Other parts were played by Geoffrey Whitehead, David Collings, John Hartley, Zulema Dean, Tracy Wiles, and David Timpson. The Creative Impulse was dramatised by Neville Teller and directed by Janet Whittaker.
Are you ready for an adventure?
Now, what can I do for you?
Oh, Mr. Kipps, how awfully jolly of you to come.
I can't believe it.
Who is that old lady at the bottom of the garden?
Oh, that's Miss Marple.
All right, who's up next?
Knowing me, Alan Partridge. Knowing you, Shirley D. Aha.
This is my son, Ivan.
You know what he said?
I'm looking for ways to keep this library open.
Have you tried wedging the front door with a shoe?
Something and something big had made that trail.
Forgive me!
I shall say exactly what I like to you, and if you don't like it, you can get out.
I just ought to laugh at that.
And then all of this can be yours.
the best drama, the best comedy,